AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 60 for Thursday, June 17, 2010. Branding Bland. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, here we are, AutoLine After Hours, once again. And joining us, as always, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, I don't know what to do over here.
Well, we'll figure it out before the end of the show. And with us, as always, too, David Welch from Bloomberg Business Week.
Glad to be here, John.
And also joining us for the show, Skyping in from Christmas Cove in Maine, the state of Maine, is Charlie Hughes.
John, great to be with you.
Well, there's a lot of topics to get into. And, Charlie, we want to bring you in because, let's see, if I remember this right, you used to run Land Rover in North America. And you used to run Mazda in North America. What am I missing here? What else? You wrote a book with William Jeans called Brand Rules.
Branding Iron.
Branding Iron. Brand Rules is the company. Excuse me.
Inspired by me, Charlie.
Obviously. You know, the subtitle was Branding Lessons from the Meltdown of the U.S. Auto Industry, which was published in fall of 2006. So we felt we were pretty far ahead of the curve with the book.
Yeah, I think the Automotive Task Force read your book and figured out which brands they had to get rid of. But before we get into all that, what else did I miss? You were with Land Rover, you were with Jaguar, Land Rover and Mazda. What else?
It's hard to believe. I was with 8 car companies, worked on 11 different brands, and was head of marketing operations for Porsche out in the United States, for Volkswagen, and for Fiat and Lancia.
Yeah, I met Charlie when he was at Fiat North America.
Oh, well, we'll be talking about Lancia later tonight, too, then.
I mean, Charlie and I go back.
John, one quick story on Lancia. When I got there, it's the first time in my career I had an opportunity to sell 3 model years worth of cars sitting in ports at one time, most of which had only been painted twice.
You're right. That is a good story. Hey, but let's jump to the news that broke today. J.D. Powers with this initial quality survey that shows the Detroit 3, for the first time in J.D. Powers history, beat out the imports for quality. What do you guys make of this?
Well, it's significant. Whether or not the American consumer public will believe it or get, you know, understand it, the significance, that remains to be seen, but it is significant.
But dig into the numbers a bit. Ford did really well. Toyota tumbled way down. GM backslid, and Chrysler's still back of the pack. So to me, that it's significant, but it's more the change Toyota versus Ford.
Yeah, it's that, right, too.
Ford is also the highest-ranked mass-market brand. They finished 5th. The 4 above it were
all luxury
Porsche
brands.
Acura and Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm missing, who is the 4th? Porsche, Acura, Mercedes.
Charlie, you got the list there. Who else is there?
I do, but then you're forcing me to put my glasses back on. Let me see here a second. The top group was Porsche at 83, Acura at 86, Mercedes at 87, Lexus at 88,
That's right.
And then Ford at 93. And by the way, Peter, just a quick rebuttal, but not living in Detroit and actually spending most of my time with what I'll call civilians or non-industry people,
yeah,
there is a growing feeling and recognition about what's happening with Ford and specifically with their quality. And I think in that regard, Consumer Reports has played a major role.
Yeah, but I think Peter makes a good point. I think a lot of America will be skeptical. And the only way to change that perception is they got to do this for years now.
Well, but to Charlie's point, I think people are buying it with Ford because they've been doing this, as Dave Sargent from J.D. Power said today, for 9 years Ford's been really working on this and improving. GM's been making strides. Their quality isn't bad, but they backslid today, and it was based on their new models. I thought GM's results were very disappointing. Chrysler showed better results, But they're still so far back.
But, you know, when you say far back, it's interesting because I did the math on this. If you look at Porsche at the top of the list and Land Rover, I'm sorry, Charlie, at the bottom of the list.
Nothing changes.
Yeah, nothing. Right. If you do the math, there's only 0.6 defects between the best and the worst. And I say, can the public really measure that? And I just ask that rhetorically. I'm not necessarily putting them down. It's so close. Even between the best and the worst, it's like half a defect.
And everybody says that. And my response to that is, if it were really that close and it was statistically irrelevant, you would think that you could just take all the car brands, put them in a bag, shake it up, and you'd get a different answer every year. But you don't. Okay, Ford has been climbing. Honda's always up there. Other than this whole recall mess, Toyota had always been up there. Hyundai has been steadily climbing. GM, even when GM was making a lot of progress and they weren't falling backwards, they were doing well, but they hadn't really cracked. Cadillac had cracked the top five, but their mass market brands hadn't. So you do see a lot of kind of the same suspects in similar areas in a lot of these surveys, and that's why I think it is still significant. There are enough problems where you can tell who the leaders are and who's making progress and who isn't.
But, Charlie, you know, there's no question that Ford is on an upward trajectory. And, yeah, when you get out into the mass America out there, Ford definitely has a buzz associated to it that we haven't seen. I mean, ever since the debacle in Washington and the government buyouts and payoffs and whatever, Ford has definitely become America's car company, and to the detriment of Toyota and to the detriment of Chrysler and General Motors. And they're delivering the products, too. So, yeah, I think the buzz is out there. You know, it's probably not there in the Smile States and California and the other bastions of, you know, not going to believe American cars are worth a damn states out there, but
I think there's recognition that there's progress.
Yeah, there's recognition there's progress.
But you have to do this over a long period of time. And I've been, I think, fairly skeptical of Ford being all of that. The one thing they do really have is quality, and so does Hyundai, and that's why they've been making progress in the survey and with market share. GM's quality, like I said, it's not that their quality is bad, but they got to start scoring some wins in Consumer Reports and in J.D. Power for people to believe that they're back. And they're just not. I was really disappointed with what GM did today what they showed, because these are the new models. I understand new models have problems more so than the stuff that's been on the market for 5 years because they've had some time to work through the bugs. I get that. But these are the cars that they want to gain market share and gain price. And they have been gaining acceptance in the market. No question about it. All the new products are pretty hot. But it shows that they're not there with quality if they're taking a backslide just because they had a lot of new cars.
Well, but that's one of the points. Go ahead, Charlie.
The number one car, I think, as I read this quickly, was the Porsche Pan America, which throws that whole we can't get a new car right out of the gate theory. The other thing, John, is when you talk about, you know, doesn't seem to be that much difference from the top to the bottom. It really depends on what kind of faults you're looking at. So I know from my experience with the bottom resider, that if it's idiot lights coming on the dash soon, early in the period, that's a really, even though it may only be one light or something, that really irritates the bejesus out of a new car buyer. So, you know, not all faults are born equal.
No, that's right. And I think J.D. Power has done a good job over the years. And remember, they've been doing this for a long time now of weighting the seriousness of a defect. So if it's a loose ashtray, it's one thing. If it's a blown head gasket, it gets weighted a whole lot more. But getting to your point, David, I mean, one of the things that J.D. Power made a point of is everybody pretty much improved overall. And it said the real reason for that is because the quality of launches has improved so much. And that's what really impressed them is with so many new models, especially at Ford, it was still able to improve quality. And I'd have one other point, too, is...
The thing is, GM doesn't have an excuse.
It has no excuses whatsoever. That's exactly right. But one other thing, too, that I find interesting is how fast Toyota fell. And I said this back earlier this year, that my feeling was the myth that Toyota had perfect quality was smashed with all the recalls and the unintended acceleration and all that. And all of a sudden, Americans realized, oh, they're not perfect. Well, guess what? They never were. The perception was that they were perfect. Now it is not. And my prediction was, you watch, when Consumer Reports and J.D. Power rolls around, we're going to see Toyota's quality go down because people who bought Toyotas and said, oh, yeah, you never have any problems. All you do is change the oil and nothing happens, never wanted to admit, I think, yeah, I had a problem with my Toyota, you know, because they'd be admitting they're the only idiot that ever had a problem. And my perception was people would be now more willing to criticize their Toyotas on these surveys. And I'm wondering if that's what we're seeing part of right now in them dropping so fast.
Well, Dave Sargent said there was some of that, but he said a lot of the problems that were checked off in the boxes on Toyota were stuff specific to the recalls. Brake pedals, floor mats, accelerator pedals, all of that stuff. So a lot of it was just somebody's car was involved in the recall. There's a problem. It's a problem. Right? It was recalled. So he said that was the majority of it, too. So these were legitimate things. And that's why he was saying that now that Toyota seems to have gotten a lot of the recall stuff behind it and 2011 model year probably won't be affected by all of these problems, they should be able to improve in the survey. Improving the reputation is going to be another issue. I'm not convinced he's completely right because the same product development system and purchasing system that kicked out vehicles with all of these problems still engineered and designed these cars that are on the road and being sold right now. So, and it's, as you guys know, it's really tough once a car is on the market to make big, big changes like that unless you know that something's already broken.
Well, I've always said, too, anyway, the IQS is interesting, but it only measures quality after 90 days of ownership. And everything should work for the first 3 months, shouldn't it? So I put more credence in their vehicle dependability survey, which I guess will be out later in the year.
Yeah, well, and the IQS, I mean, come on. That was the one where Hummer H2 buyers said, it doesn't get good gas mileage. Really?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, an IQS, it can be anything from the engine caught on fire to there's too much wind noise to the cup holder doesn't fit my big gulp.
My big gulp, yeah. Right.
Hey, you know that, John?
Yeah.
One last thing. If you just look at it as contrasting Ford with General Motors, I really think it shows the power of one team that knows who they are, where they're going, and another team that does not. And, I mean, when you consider what General Motors and all the people working there have gone through, I think it's probably amazing that they did as well as they've done.
Good point, and that's a great segue into, I think, the next topic we got to cover of news that broke this week of General Motors saying it's not going to ask the German government or any European government to help it restructure Opel. It was just going to do it all on its own.
Well, they don't have time to sit around and go through another round of can you loan us some money. They want to IPO this thing. The biggest question as far as GM's profitability and it being a good investment is Opel. Because they're making money in North America now, and they're doing great in Brazil and in Asia. Opel's lost half a billion dollars in the first quarter, so they've got to get that restructuring underway, and they're just going to have to fund it themselves and start to move on.
But, Peter, what do you make of them, you know, almost all the way up until this point saying, oh, we can't do this without government money. Oh, we need to have them underwrite the loans or back them up or whatever, and then all of a sudden go, nah, no, we don't need anything.
Well, I think David's right. I think they're out of time, and they've got the cash. They've got more cash than they thought they would have, and I think they're just saying, you know, we're going to get out from under this government stuff, whether it's over here or over there, and we might as well start over there and prepare ourselves for getting out from under it here. But I don't think they have any choice. I mean, they experienced the German government up close and personal, and they know it's not going anywhere. So
right.
If they're going to fix Opel, they have to fix Opel themselves.
And they have to do it fast. If they want an IPO in the fourth quarter or even the first quarter, spending another 3-4 months
dealing with negotiating
with governments to get loan programs and what that means for preserving jobs and all this sort of thing, or guaranteeing products or dealing with labor unions, they don't have that kind of time because they need to go to investors and say, here's what's wrong with Opel. Here's how we're going to fix it. Here's how we're going to fund it. And that money that we're going to fund this restructuring with, here's the return you're going to get because we think XYZ is going to happen. And if you have all of this uncertainty, it's tougher to say that.
You know, I think they shot themselves in the foot when they came out at the end of the first quarter bragging that they had $35 billion in cash and securities.
Yeah.
I think that's when the Germans went, hey, what are we giving them money for?
Yeah, Yeah, exactly.
So putting the coin on the other side, though, I think it's a sign of pragmatism within GM management, which is refreshing. They knew they weren't going to get the money.
Yeah, well, it's good they acted like they did, to your point, David. Mm-hmm. Hey, I don't know if you guys caught the story that we ran that came out of Ward's of hackers being able to hack into your car's computer, even disable the brakes remotely while your car is running, fix it so that the engine can't turn on or can't turn off. They can even hack into your dashboard and give you false gas readings on your gas gauge so that you could run out of gas or change your speedometer so that you could be tricked into speeding. This stuff is chilling. I mean, you know, it's bad enough that we got all these other hackers out there. I can't believe.
How do they do that?
There's two ways. They can physically go in through a diagnostic port and hack into the computer. And there's some way that they can do it wirelessly on certain models, which, of course, thank God they didn't identify. But they said there's no stopping anybody who really knows what they're doing.
Yeah, it's just scary. I mean, everyone warmly embraces the electronic revolution coming. Boy, I'll tell you, it's going to have a dark side, too. Hopefully we won't see that with mass crashes on the L.A. freeway or something because some mad hacker has managed to crack the code.
Like in the Italian Job when Seth Green was able to hack into the L.A. traffic signal system.
Yeah.
I know. It's scary, but worth worrying about. Did you guys also see Nissan released this week the noises it wants its electric car, the Leaf, to make so that people who are blind or, visually impaired or anything can hear these things coming?
Well, and that was right out of Tron, too. I mean, you know, back when I tried to get the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation off the ground, remember part of the rules was each manufacturer had to come up with their own sound signature. You know, it could sound like a V16, or I think you wanted it to sound like a V16 or something.
I think you should be able to download it like a ringtone for yourself.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we even had one viewer.
But then, you know, I watched your little thing and the Nissan went by and it was just like a science fiction movie. It just went by and it made the weird...
Almost Jetsons-like.
Yeah, and I was just like, if this is the future, man.
Here it is.
Yeah, I mean...
Sounds very turbine-like.
Yeah,
hey, Ben, play the other one of it backing up. Do you have that?
Dive!
Just shootme.com. You know, it's going to make you want to just put a V8 away.
Yeah.
So you can bring it out on Sundays and make all kinds of noise in the neighborhood.
Right. Though there is a very interesting Detroit area connection to that. There's an organization in town, the Detroit Institute of Ophthalmology, which actually puts on the Eyes on Design car show, which is this Sunday, by the way, folks, if you want to see a pretty cool show, classic cars, but organized by car designers, not by the concours type people. But anyway, the Institute of Ophthalmology works with people who have lost their vision or just about. And they worked with them to help develop this noise because apparently the first noise that Nissan came up with, the blind people were like, no, that's not going to work at all. Because especially if we get to a four-way intersection and there's all different kinds of cars or all different kinds of electric cars coming with these noises, I don't know what Nissan had before, but they helped them figure out this Jetsons kind of noise that they said worked a whole lot better for them in all kinds of different traffic situations.
Wow.
Just kind of interesting. And then another one topic that we got to talk to before we get into our discussion with Charlie here is the UAW elections this week. What do y'all make of that?
Well, UAW elections are roughly as predictable as like the old Soviet elections. I mean, you know, it's scripted. You know who's going to be. Not that there are any parallels between unionism and communism, but you know who's going to be in. It's been Bob King coming forever, and he's already rattling the saber. He's going to organize Toyota plants. He wants to maybe get some concessions back.
Same old BS, same old rhetoric, same old, all the car companies are making money, so, you know, we're going to get ours. And it's just like, really, guys?
Well, think about organizing Toyota plants. What's he got to sell? You're going to pay your dues, and you're going to get the UAW contract, which starts at half the wage it used to. So the UAW plants have backtracked. And by the way, Toyota just closed the one UAW plant they had.
Yeah, well, Bob King came out today saying, hey, yeah, that's all they're doing. They closed that plant down to move Corolla production out of NUMMI down to Mississippi, where it's going to be non-union.
Yeah.
So, but I'm with you. I just don't see where the union has all that good of a story to sell.
No, I mean, it's over. It's been over. They just haven't gotten a memo. That's what I wrote about this week. And it's just too bad because we have to sit through that and... You know, and I wrote this actually a couple months ago on the table. I said, beware of Bob King. This guy's going to be a nightmare.
I remember you saying that.
A frickin' nightmare.
I remember
you saying that. I don't know. I don't think the union has enough leverage to be a nightmare, and it depends on...
Yeah, except we have to listen to it because we happen to live in Michigan.
I think they still do have a lot of leverage with the Detroit Three. I really do. I mean... they can bring these guys to their knees in a heartbeat. And that's why they got all the great benefits and wages and holidays and jobs bank and all this other stuff they got over the years. Because, you know, I still point to that, was it the 1997 strike that GM took and lost $3 billion on? For all the right reasons, they took the strike and they got their brains kicked in.
Yeah. Well, we keep forgetting that that UAW has a monopoly. That was because of the 1935 Wagner Labor Act. And whenever you can sit down and say, we're going to have a pattern agreement, that is a monopoly. I mean, and so that's what they're used to. And they now have a monopoly to the point where I guess they could put somebody out of business, as irrational as that sounds. But I'm more intrigued by the fact that it seems to me there's a sizable conflict of interest between a UAW that has sizable ownership in Chrysler and GM and no ownership in Ford, and the first thing they do is refuse to give Ford parity with the other ones. That sounds like a clear conflict of interest. I'm just wondering whether there's any legal founding that grounding that Ford would have to do something about that.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, they've made no bones about the fact that they're going to go after Ford in the next contract.
Of course, legally, the union doesn't own the shares. The healthcare trust does.
Right. And that's probably the specific answer to Charlie's question.
Yeah, that's the
way. Well, that may be the legal answer, but I find it difficult to believe that they're not going to behave differently.
Yeah.
Time will tell.
But that's enough for some of the highlights of the news that took place this week. You know, Charlie, we brought you in because we wanted to get your insight of what's going on, especially from a brand standpoint. And when I was talking to you yesterday, a couple of things that you threw out there that I thought, man, we got to get into is, you know, GM axed four brands. Ford got rid of four brands. It's going to close down Mercury. And what you said is Infiniti and Acura are two brands that really have never gained any traction.
That's interesting.
Well, I think in the case of Acura, it was Honda misreading what they needed to do. They felt they needed a Mercury step-up brand for people who had bought Japanese cars and wanted something slightly above. And that all got eclipsed, obviously, when the Lexus came out. Infiniti has never really found its position. But I say that, John, because we're living in a world now where mass market is moving up market. If you look at an interior of the Ford Fiesta or any of their new cars, or look at the Hyundai Sonata and you say, why do you need a mid-level car anymore? You simply don't. And the interesting opposite effect of that is if you look at, which I did at the New York Auto Show, if you look at Honda interiors versus some other people's interiors, it almost seems like they're being held back on the Honda side because of their need to differentiate Acura from Honda. But Acura really is just a slightly better trim, slightly different looking Honda. And I don't know what its role is. I will say one thing, though, Peter, I was interested in your article on the Mazda 3. And I would say that Acura would give Mazda a run for its money on who has the most grotesque front-end styling. But that's,
it's a toss-up, that's for sure.
But we know from history that people who understand where they are in the marketplace, et cetera, tend to do a better job on front-end design than people who don't. So I'll just throw that out. Given Honda's great technical expertise, you would expect an Acura brand to be a rear-wheel drive vehicle, to be something which is so high tech that it puts all the other Japanese car companies on the trailer. It's just not that way.
The only one they had was the NSX, and they walked away from it.
The other thing, if you look at Infiniti, as we know from a very difficult start with rocks and trees, et cetera, it has never found its position, and it's wandered and waffled all over the place. I know the current management is intent on quote unquote, in their mind, doing the right things, rear-wheel drive platforms, keep with the same advertising for 5 years or so, but they have a mountain to climb to get past the fact that for years they were the, let's say, economical, low lease price alternative to a real luxury car that somebody wanted. And so the cars were always okay, but they were never positioned in a way that you would get excited about them. And I think that's still true. So while certainly Nissan has done a better job, a more honest job of positioning Infiniti than Honda has, I don't think either one of those cars have elevated themselves out of the competition level with other mass merchandise brands.
So should they axe the brands, Infiniti and Acura?
Well, I wouldn't axe the brands, but I think there's going to be very little no man's land between mass merchandise products and real luxury products. I think you got to make a choice of which one you're going to be in.
Well, Charlie, you hear brands like Acura and Buick saying, we're not luxury, we're premium. Saab says that. Whenever I hear that, I think, okay, these guys don't really know what they are. And it turns out that those brands never really have a brand image to talk about. It's always, we're just nicer than Chevys or nicer than Hondas or we're not every man's car, but they don't seem to have the conviction to say we're a true luxury brand. I mean, what do you think? I mean, when someone starts throwing the premium word around, what comes to your mind?
When I hear premium, I hear tweener.
Yeah.
You know, we're between mass merchandise. But the truth is, to buy a car costs a lot of money these days, and people expect any car they go into to be well-equipped. I mean, it's not like you're going to say, well, we're going to have cruise control and power windows in our premium brand, and they're not everywhere else. I mean, I'm looking at the new Hyundais, the new Fords, and I'm saying, and by the way, this has been true of Volkswagen for years, that the interiors of those cars are darn near as good looking as anybody's interior. Buick, to me, by the way, is a special case because we know that they kept Buick because of China. And I think they're going to constantly be fighting a battle as to what Buick stands for in the United States. I think that decision was made for other reasons. But I don't know. Do you guys think that there's room in the marketplace for a premium brand?
There's dead silence. Yeah. Go ahead, Peter.
And, you know, I don't know. I mean, in terms of Infiniti and Acura, what I'm hearing you say is they either need to go way upscale and go toe-to-toe with, the established leaders, or they need to just go away. And, because the Hyundais of the world and the Fords of the world are getting better and better and better, and Charlie, you're right about that. So there's no distinction. There's no reason for being for Infiniti and Acura, especially when Acura's got that really ugly stick design school going on. I don't know. The premium thing, Buick exists because of China. I'm driving a LaCrosse this week. Very nice car, but are they ever going to resurrect Buick in this country? I don't know.
It's going to take more models and a lot more money to be able to pull that.
Yeah, and it's almost like it's secondary whether they do or not because China is so.
But your question about is there room in the market for a premium brand is a really good one because if you go back historically in this country, Cadillac was the epitome. It was the top. Everybody recognized it was a standard for the world. But there are some people, even if they had the money, they didn't want to be that flashy. They didn't want to brag to their friends and neighbors that they had lots of money. So they got a Buick.
Or an Oldsmobile.
Or an Oldsmobile.
And there were profiles for Buick. There were doctors and lawyers.
Right.
And they actually talked about it that way. And they didn't want to. In fact, I think it was someone at Buick who was telling me that, part of the roots were that when the doctor came calling, if he drove a Chevy, you would figure that he couldn't be a very good doctor. He wasn't making enough money. But if he drove a Cadillac, he was ripping you off. So he wanted something in the middle.
A sensible, dependable car was the Buick.
But that's all been blown up.
But well, it's been blown up because we have so much more competition today, so many more brands, so many more companies. And if you look at a Mercedes-Benz, which at least globally goes from A-class to C-class and then into the SUVs and beyond.
Look at Audi now, selling a million cars a year globally.
Right. But and they've extended where their brands are so much that to come in and say your premium doesn't mean nearly what it did 50 years ago.
I think it's pretty much irrelevant.
Yeah, John, one of the things that's intriguing me, though, is we are in a sea change in the car business right now for a whole host of reasons. And I think that the, you know, the financial meltdown, et cetera, has only accelerated it. But whenever you go through a sea change in an industry, what happens is a lot of the commanding brands fall by the wayside, and brands that we don't even know about surface. So a lot of this discussion, as we move toward electric vehicles, which is a sly way of moving the topic a little bit, but they become irrelevant because I think there are going to be a lot of old brands, current brands that fall by the wayside. My hope, and I'm an optimist, but there are going to be some exciting things to come out of the woodwork. And if I were Honda or Nissan with Infiniti and Acura, I'd try to be fighting an entirely different battle. I'd try to be taking those brands somewhere so new that people couldn't even fathom it. They'd be scratching their heads until they figured it out.
Well, did Nissan make a mistake making the Leaf, their electric car, a Nissan and not an Infiniti?
I don't think they made a mistake doing that because they know that they're going to have to crack this market with price. So, but another example is, you know, what is going to happen with Saab? And I think the answer is, if Saab doesn't bring some really interesting and arresting technology to the marketplace, Saab isn't going to make it. But Saab can reinvent itself if it really goes out on a limb. Whether it has enough capital to do that, I don't really know. But if it can come up with some, you know, new mix of hybrid that gives them the best winter performance driving and economy, whatever it might be, that puts a different spin on it, they need to do that because they've got to stand out, right? I think this sort of plussing and minusing by 2 or 3% just isn't going to cut it anymore.
That's an interesting point about Saab. I have a story in the magazine coming out tomorrow on a pretty lengthy one, talking to Victor Mower and a lot of Saab owners about what this brand needs to be. And Saab is, frankly, I really don't think long-term it can work because you talk to the real Saab lovers, the guys who make that brand, and they liked some of those quirky things, but also some of the technology that the brand had going back, turbocharging and some of those other things that they really became known for. And for Saab to do what Charlie's saying, which is what the brand needs to do, they need money. And as a small independent player, they don't have the cash to do it. Now, Victor says, I can work with other companies and buy things, which everybody is doing. I get that. But that's not going to be unique to Saab if you're buying someone else's stuff.
Well, if you're buying it from another car company, he could go out on a limb and do something crazy. You know, we had Don Runkel here talking about his little Eco Motors engine that is truly revolutionary. So if Saab had the wherewithal to commit to putting something like that in production or commit to having a supplier do that for them, that might be a way to do it. But that's the only way I see them coming up with unique technology, yes. David, because I agree with you. If they're going to buy it from another car company, who cares? But if you buy it from some supplier who's come up with something really unique and different that the big guys are reluctant to invest in because they've got investment in some other technology that they can't walk away from, that's a way that Saab could really come up with something new and different.
Well, I think new and different starts with a design, and they need to do that new reimagine 92.
Yep,
right.
That's the point I make in the story.
They have to have a visual driving difference for Saab, or it won't last. And they have to go out on a limb.
No, you're right. That car could be the spearhead for the brand.
92 could do it.
Yeah, and if they did it, then everyone said, oh, yeah, that's a Saab. They have a reason for being. But
supposedly they're negotiating with BMW to get many platforms, engines, and gearboxes to do it. Well, not supposedly they are, but, you know, again, you get down to how unique can you make the car if you're buying the stuff from someone else. It can be done. Mm-hmm. Then it gets into the execution and the black art of doing all that.
Well, they're gonna have to take some chances, but there's a company in Rochester, New York that's got sort of like a second or third generation of a Torsen differential that makes claims, just using this as an example, guys, I don't own any stock in it, but that makes claims that by using this differential, you achieve about 85% of what you achieve with a four-wheel drive system. Now, let's assume for a moment that that's true. That's the type of technology that Saab's going to have to put in the car, where they end up having a certain amount of capability that they can brag about, but they have a cheaper, better solution, cheaper, lighter, better solution than somebody else has. It's kind of hard to own that, I understand, but they're going to have to do something from a technology standpoint that makes them interesting again.
You know, they don't have to own that technology forever. If they get a reputation for coming up with stuff like that, and we don't know if that works, but it's a for instance, and they get a reputation for coming up with these cool things first off and being a leader on some kind of innovative or quirky technologies, they could survive as a brand. Long term, though, it's really tough to do that.
It's so expensive. It's so expensive to do it that way. I'm curious, you're a brand guy, so I'm looking at Chrysler's management structure and would like your input of how Sergio Marchionne has made these guys not brand managers. He's made them CEOs of the brand with full profit and loss responsibility for them. What do you think of this arrangement?
I think it's pure genius. I mean, if you want to separate out why some of the import car companies work better than the domestic, it's because the people running the import car companies have P&L responsibility to set up as businesses. Now, they vary in the degree of autonomy they have, the different management systems, but those are real businesses. When you run a Honda, or if you're running a Toyota in North America, admittedly, they have an awful lot of expatriates there, but that is a standalone business that is run as a P&L center. In my mind, in Detroit, for too long after they moved past the divisional setup to GM, that thing got diffused. You know, everybody was responsible for it and nobody was. So I think that puts pure accountability into their system, and I really like it. It also allows leadership to bloom. So he's going to find out who can lead under difficult circumstances a lot faster than you would in this, you know, dog's breakfast at General Motors, where we have somebody in charge of marketing to be determined each week, and somebody in charge of sales. And, you know, I mean, that system just cannot work. That's going to fail. So I like what they're doing there. I will say one thing, though. The separating Ram from Dodge, to me, is a more direct approach to try and take away Dodge's position, hard-earned position, as being the American male testosterone brand. I mean, they tried earlier by just saying, oh, well, we'll soften the advertising and try and appeal to women or whatever. But I think that's a serious mistake. I think Dodge, if it's going to have a future, is going to remain an American testosterone brand. The Pontiac gone, they have a very good chance of making it work. And everything they do that whittles away at that is just a huge mistake. It becomes an even bigger mistake when you realize that all of these cars are going to be sold through the Chrysler supermarket, which is going to get very confusing when we have some launches of Fiat sitting there.
Yeah, my view was the separation of Ram and Dodge is more of a outside of North America kind of a play, where if you take a Dodge into a market, it's going to be hard for people who have never really seen the brand to get their mind around the fact that there's a commercial vehicle aspect to it and a passenger car aspect to it. Because these Rams are all going to be sold in Dodge dealerships, I think it's going to take years for most Americans to catch on to the fact that they are separate brands now.
Yeah, but you're hiring people, you're paying people money to try and make them separate. And that, to me, is the mistake. I think they feed off of each other. But, John, I think you're absolutely right. The European mentality just struggles with pickup trucks. It's just an anathema to them. But they shouldn't struggle with the positive halo effect for branding, because certainly, given the media that we have, the global media, people in Europe know Americans love pickup trucks, and they certainly play a big role in an awful lot of TV and movies, et cetera. And I think a parallel there would be the fact that many Americans who buy Mercedes know that Mercedes is the number one cab used in Germany, and they view that as a testimony to the fine engineering. So I don't think it's incompatible, but I just think when you spend 15 years trying to position a brand a certain way and you're making headway, and then somebody says, oops, this won't appeal to a broad enough market, we've got to soften the image. Well, that's a huge mistake. I mean, they're wiping out years of the benefit of having Viper and having a lot of other things to make Dodge stand for something.
That's why I will reserve the genius word for old Sergio when I start seeing the real the real deliverables. And, you know, they are a long way from getting out of the woods. I'm just not buying all the smoke and mirrors he's got going.
I'm not either, because they may be making a small operating profit, which means they've cut enough costs. And basically, I think what they've probably done is shifted so much engineering work over to the Fiat side that a lot of that fixed cost is gone. That's great, but their market share keeps falling. And until they recover in the market, they could just be on that Detroit treadmill we've seen with all three companies until recently, where they were downsizing to the next crisis. You know, they would downsize, get back in the black briefly, and then the next crisis would come. But they never solved their problems with consumers and with product. And we have no evidence to believe that Chrysler has done that yet.
Well, I don't know whether Marchionne is a genius or not, Peter, but what I'm saying is that if I look at their management setup, that gives them the best chance of surviving that I can see. And I agree with you. There's nothing particularly great going on there now. But at least you've got dedicated people who have clear responsibilities trying to do their best. They have limited tools, but it's clear who's in charge.
Well, good. I think this is a good point in time to transition into getting all the questions from our viewers right now. So, Ben, let's get into our rapid fire. Okay, Ralph Norick says, I often hear people discussing U.S. cars, comparing them, Pinto versus Civic versus Corolla, but they forget to remember that in the 60s or 70s, imports had many quality problems. He says, was J.D. Power doing IQS in those days? Not in the 60s or 70s. J.D. Power didn't come in until the early 80s, I think.
It's a 24-year-old study, so you're, I guess, 86 then.
I think it was earlier than that. The IQS wasn't the first survey that they
did. Oh, no. You're saying, okay.
They had sales.
I first met David in, I think it was 75 or 76, and he was just starting his company then. And his first, the first report was CSI.
Yeah.
But
right.
I don't remember. I don't remember when it was, but it had to have been, I think, in the late 70s.
And Ralph Norick wants to know, how did domestic compares cars compared to imports in decades past? They were bad. I mean, that's how J.D. Power got on the map, was pointing out the difference in the quality between the imports and the domestics. Jason Jadosh, and I know I butchered it again, Jason, I'm sorry. He says, from 1 to 10, everybody, how important do you guys feel Opel is to GM?
He said 1 to 10?
1 to 10.
Oh, it's 7 or 8.
7 or 8 is what I'd say,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I'd say 8.
Charlie?
I'd say 9.
A 9, okay.
I don't see in the world today when you're competing against people who are building multiple platforms to serve all the markets that you can compete without the ability to do the same thing.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does the panel recommend for Honda in its current spiral?
I think Honda has to get back to what they were known for. Innovative, fun to drive, march to a different drummer, quit this namby-pamby, apologetic, you know, stance, and just be like their founder was at the very beginning. I mean, they lost that, and they need to get that back.
And they need somebody to go in there and do what Lutz did at GM, which is free up the designers. I'm sure there are good designers in that company, just like there were at GM when they were turning out bricks.
Yeah.
They just need, whether it's engineering or manufacturing or accounting, to get their mitts off the cars and let these guys make something that has real design proportions and it just isn't goofy looking. And often it's the system that constrains that.
I think they lost their mojo about 8 years ago from a technology standpoint. If you recall, there was a time when every kid in Los Angeles wanted to have a Civic, and they knew what the different series engines were, and you know, all the Fast and Furious nonsense. And then, of course, they replace it with a car that's darn near impossible to do anything with. It just seems like they've walked away from their heritage, and they need to get that back. And that's leadership.
Okay, 007 Mitch wants to know, Charlie, we'll throw this to you. Oh, he actually does say, how can Charlie explain how Land Rover succeeded despite poor quality?
Well, we touched an emotional nerve. I think we did an awful lot of things well. But as one of my friends said, if we had had only industry average quality, we would have sold two or three times more products that we sold. I mean, I could tell you stories that would either bring tears or laughter, which I'll spare everybody. But it was always a difficult road for us to hoe. I'm a little disappointed with the results now, though, because I know that they've done an awful lot of work to improve the quality of the product, but it just doesn't seem to be showing up.
Devin Rose says, Peter, what's the latest chatter about the upcoming Impala that you've talked about? Any chance it might be based on the Holden Commodore?
There's all kinds of chatter, but all I keep saying is it's going to be good, it's going to be good. And I talked to some of my design contacts, and they said we're pulling out all the stops. But as far as the actual mechanicals, there's too many conflicting stories right now. I believe it'll be a rear-wheel drive with all-wheel drive option.
I'm laughing because I'm already reading the next question. David Welch, would our resident bagpiper please explain why vuvuzelas make watching World Cup soccer more bearable?
This has nothing to do with piping, by the way. Bagpipes are the most beautiful sound a musical instrument could possibly make, where the vuvuzelas just sounds like... I was watching the replay of the Spain-Switzerland game, which was a terrific upset, Switzerland beating Spain 1-0, and you know, Spain is one of the favorites to possibly win the thing. But and all you can hear is that hum of the vuvuzela, and it sounds like somebody has about 200 of those model flying airplanes buzzing through the stadium, or there's something wrong with the audio equipment for the company that's transmitting the game. It's really awful.
It's fucking ridiculous. And I, you know, I refuse to, I won't listen to it. I'll turn the volume off. I refuse.
Well,
to.
Well, I watched the U.S.-England game at the Clatter, the Irish pub up the street from here. And, of course, we're in this really packed pub, and it was like being in a pub in London watching a game. Everyone's chanting. It's packed shoulder to shoulder, heavy drinking going on. So you can see the game in these big screen TVs, but you can't hear the vuvuzela. So when people are complaining to me about this, I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. So when I finally saw a game this week, I'm like, God, it's bad.
It's bad. I don't know how the players deal with it. You know, it's just nuts. Jay Cujo wants to know, Peter, have you seen the Lambda Caddy design, and does it differentiate itself from the others?
Yes, and sort of, but not enough.
Not enough. Uh-oh. Let me get to another question here, Ben, and then we'll get to one of the phone calls that we have in here. Pedro Fernandez wants to know, Charlie, in your opinion, if the Acura line had not been hit by the ugly stick, do you think their sales would have been better, or don't they suffer from an image problem?
Yeah, I think, first, yes, their sales could be better, because I think it's hard to get past some of the things that they're doing right now. But I think the other thing is they're positioned as virtually as a trim level above a Honda, and it just the whole strategy is not working. But plus the reverse part of it is it's hurting Honda, because you can't let Honda be all that Honda might be if Acura weren't there.
I think, let me grab this one really quick, because I think you can sum up a lot of Honda's problems to doing things on the cheap. They don't want to invest in rear-drive platforms or, for that matter, all new platforms to really differentiate the performance and the design of the Acura line over the Honda brand. To Charlie's point, they're just a trim level up. Then you look at where they have failed in technology. They've invested a lot in technology, but they went on the cheap with their hybrid program. It's basically a milder system than Toyota's. So you don't get the mileage, and you don't get the size of vehicles that you get from a Toyota. So they tried to go cheap, because it makes some economic sense to try to do that, but at the end of the day, you end up with a luxury line and a hybrid technology strategy that is sort of middling and doesn't appeal to anybody.
Good point. Hey,
John,
Ben?
One last shot on this, which is, I mean, the whole theory of brand portfolios is that you add another brand when you want to attract customers that your current brand or brands cannot attract. You don't add another brand to attract the same or virtually the same customer. And that's the problem that Honda has right now with the Acura. I mean, you could call it a step up to a Honda, if you will, but it's trying to use the same types of products, the same types of technology to attract the same types of customers. And why would you duplicate all those costs?
Didn't they launch the brand as a defensive mechanism, basically, because some Honda owners who liked their Hondas were getting up in income and wanted something more expensive, and they didn't have anything to offer them, so they went after them, as opposed to what Charlie's saying is they've identified a new kind of customer and they come up with a totally different product and brand to go after them. I mean, it's a subtle difference, but it's one that, I mean, am I right about that, Charlie?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. But they just didn't dream big enough, because what they ended up saying was, oh, we have people now with more money, want something bigger, more expensive. That all made sense until, I think it was less than 3 years later, that Toyota came out with Lexus and said, the heck with something a little better, let's go for luxury. And then all of a sudden, people said, well, I don't quite get Acura then. They just didn't go far enough with it.
Well, I mean, if they want to keep Acura, then they should aim at Audi, and there should be a Acura competitor to the R8 with a V10, and it should be the successor to the NSX, and it should be OMG fabulous, and that's what I want to see from Honda, and I'm not seeing it.
By the way, I mean, Audi is a brand that's done it right with a lot of the same hardware that Volkswagen uses. Not completely
the
same.
I agree with you, David. It's an amazing balancing act that they've done, but they have elevated themselves out of the premium area, if you will, right into the luxury area, and they have as much momentum as any brand in the world right now.
Well, another thing that we keep talking about, too, is that I like to point out, Audi is a standalone company. It has its own board of directors. It has its own annual report, and that's how they run it. I don't know the precise arrangement at Honda, but my guess is Honda engineers Acuras and Hondas just as they engineer any cars, kind of like how the big three do it, and you don't get that clear differentiation. You get badge engineering. They do not an unreasonable job at Acura, but again, as we've talked about tonight, it just has never caught on.
Well, I don't know how they're doing it now, John, but when I was out on the West Coast, the marketing and product planning was done with one group for both Honda and Acura. And the sales was done by another group for both Honda and Acura. So they never quite said, we're going to do Acura to the point where there are Acura people in charge of Acura. Yeah. That may have changed over time, but that's what's always confused me.
My guess is the Honda and Acura executives are roommates.
Yep, I'm sure you're right.
Live in the same house.
Hey, Ben, let's bring in one of the phone calls that we've got here.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question this week is, why doesn't GM drop the Vauxhall nameplate in Europe? I think it's only used in the UK and Ireland. Are the Brits and the Irish that attached to that nameplate? And, you know, couldn't they save some money by doing away with it? Considering the fact that Opel's losing money, I think any savings they could get would help. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, I don't think the Irish are attached to anything English. but I'll let Charlie handle
or
the Vauxhall.
Or the Scots either, right?
I'll let Charlie answer the Vauxhall versus Opel in the United Kingdom, which Ireland is not a part of.
Yeah, I never understood that either. When I talked to people over in the UK, they'd simply say, well, you know, at one time Vauxhall was a real brand, and there are a lot of people who only want to own a Vauxhall. And I said, doesn't everybody really know that it's an Opel? And they kind of nod yes, but it's an anachronism. I don't understand why they're still doing it either, but somebody over there must think it's worth the effort.
Good point. Brett, Ben, let's bring in another one.
Hi, John. It's Ian Beavis from Nielsen. I'm watching must-see TV again. Just a comment on the value power methodology. Don't forget that we're not just dealing with what goes wrong from an actual feature standpoint. We're also dealing with design issues and that people don't understand certain controls that irritate people. And that has been an increasing component of the IQS over the last few years. So you will see some shifts from year to year based on people not understanding controls, et cetera. Thanks. Bye.
That's a great point. That's a really good point. There might be absolutely nothing wrong with a car, but if somebody doesn't understand how to control it, they mark it down as a defect.
I remember the early years when BMW came out with iDrive and Mercedes came out with Command, and buyers were saying that it was software glitches or it wasn't working. In some cases, there probably was some of that, but mostly they couldn't figure out how to use it, so they complained. They just hated it.
Well, Mercedes did have massive failures of their...
Yes, they did.
What was it, John? $7,000 a piece that they had to replace?
Oh, yeah. The nav screen was like a $7,000 dealer replacement cost.
And didn't BMW, didn't they give the dealers, the salespeople, post-it notes or something like that to sticking the cars to. There was something like that. I remember reading.
There was something like that, and how to explain the thing. But I think the caller had a really good point that just the interface, the design of the interface, can affect your quality rating.
Oh, and that and that can, particularly with new models, if there's a technology that's coming in, or even a design feature that's coming in that hasn't been in other cars and people are unfamiliar with it, you can get dinged on that. Sure.
Ben, let's bring in another one.
Hi, guys. It's Marty in Atlanta. A couple of questions for Peter. I did watch the 24 Hours last weekend. It was a fantastic race. Do you have any insight or inside information as to how Peugeot can be so utterly dominating last year and such an utter disaster this year? And the second question is, are you related to Matt DiLorenzo, the editor of Road and Track? Thanks, guys. Great show.
Matt's my cousin. Victor DiLorenzo, the drummer of the Violent Femmes, is my cousin, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Get out of here. You never told me that.
Yeah, I did. You weren't listening.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I would have remembered that.
Peugeot was blistering fast this year. They were even faster than they were last year.
3 to 4 seconds a lap.
Over the Audis. And,
which is massive.
Yeah. And they were just going for it. They hadn't won before last year. They hadn't won since... Was it 93 or 83? It was a while, 93, I think. And so they were going to pour on the coals. They wanted to humiliate Audi. And just when you think everything's going just tremendous, we got this, you know, we got this one. The wheels fell off. They had failures. And Audi improved their cars and called them the R15 Plus. And, you know, you got to be there at the end.
Yep. First finish, then finish first.
So, yeah, Peugeot dominated. They were fastest. They're sexy-looking cars, beautiful race cars. But I tell you what, history will reflect 25 years down the road when you read who won in 2010. It's going to be Audi. One, two, three.
Right. I was disappointed in Speed's coverage because I was very interested in following the Corvettes.
Well, yeah.
GT2, and there was, like, next to no coverage of what was going on.
Well, they didn't have control of the feed, which is a big problem for them. You heard them. Remember, they're saying that,
yeah.
Well, I don't know what the director's thinking of. We really wanted to stay on that, and they didn't have any control over it. But, yeah, you had to catch up with Corvette, and... Corvette and Ricci Competizione had a massive battle for an hour, the two of them, for the lead in GT2, nose to tail, flat out. So, yeah, we missed all that.
Yeah.
Who won that race?
The Corvettes.
Porsche finished first in class, right?
Yeah, Porsche won. Corvette suffered their first engine failures in 11 years of running at Le Mans.
And they had one of their cars crashed out through no fault of their own.
Yeah, Peugeot passed them, and the guy got in the marbles and lost it, backed it in a guardrail. The Pratt Miller crew put a new back end on the car in 24 minutes.
Wow.
And Oliver Gavin got in the car and went out and went faster than his qualifying time. So, but then the motor broke. So they were up against it the whole way.
Ben, let's bring in another.
Hey, guys, great show. It's Jonathan Brown out in Old Japan, New Jersey. And just a quick comment. I personally disagree with the idea that the premium brands are, in fact, in trouble. I think the premium brands will sell better as time goes on. I think that it's the upper echelon, like the Mercedes S-Classes and the BMW 7 Series. Infiniti tried it with the Q45, was a dog, and quite frankly, the Acura, what was it, the Integra, was a great seller. I mean, people just want that key fob for the most part. So I think there's a lot of people that won't buy a Ford or a Chevy or, you know, even consider a Hyundai or a Kia.
Well, take that, Charlie. He says some people will buy premium brands.
Well, I certainly agree with him about the Integra. I mean, that car was a pretty hot car at the time, but now we're talking, trying to remember, 15 years ago. It was a long time ago. I just think that focus in the marketplace wins. and where you see focus being applied, and John, perhaps you may want to talk about this, but the new Jetta would be an example of a company that has just decided that it's going to make inroads into the United States, so it brings out a car that's larger, less expensive. But I'll make a bet when you get on the inside of that car, it's going to be very attractive. And that all of these new products coming out are going to make it that much more difficult for an Acura to draw people in. The other thing is, I'm not distinguishing between size. The premium, to me, is a mindset of being a step above a mass marketer. But luxury comes, as we know, in a lot of different sizes as well. So to me, luxury isn't just the 7 Series or the S-Class. It's a lot of other cars.
Quick comment on that. I don't think the S-Class and 7 Series and the big luxury cars are going to suffer. The rich are always with us.
Yeah, they are. Charlie, I like the point that you made about the new Jetta, because pretty good-looking car priced right up against the Civic and the Corolla looks way better than either one of those cars. They're knocking like at, we don't know the real pricing. They said the new one will be priced around $16,000. So I don't know if that means $16,100 or $16,900, but it's going to be at least $1,000 cheaper than the current Jetta, which is selling very well, by the way, and the new one is just going to be that much better. So finally, I think Volkswagen's got the guts to say, let's knock the price down and really go for some volume here.
Well, they're knocking the price down a lot. They're saying it's going to be like a $21,000 car, their midsize car. Now,
they're setting the table for the car they're building in.
Right, what they call the new CS or new compact sedan or something
in Tennessee,
like that.
Tennessee,
right.
The new midsize sedan is going to be in Tennessee. The compact is going to be in Mexico.
Oh, okay.
But they're going to be competitively priced with the Toyota, Honda, Chevy, Ford competitors. The problem Volkswagen is going to have is they were making really good progress in quality, and they just did terribly in the J.D. Power survey today, weren't they?
I don't remember looking at their numbers.
Charlie's going to look it up again.
I'll go back to the chart here.
My recollection is they were third from the bottom.
Your recollection is correct.
That's not good.
They were one position below Mini.
They have a history of doing that, though.
Yeah, they do.
They do, but they had made some progress the past year or two. They'd started at least getting, this isn't great, but they were in the ballpark of industry average, which at least tells buyers, okay, I'm not making a terrible decision here. And now they're down there with Mini, and I drive a Mini, Land Rover and the rest.
Well, the Jetta is setting the table for this new midsize. I mean, they're all in on that new plant,
right,
where they're going to build that.
Ben, let's bring in the next call.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York again. Quick question this week. Have any one of you guys had a chance to drive the new Jeep Grand Cherokee yet? And if so, I just was curious of your impressions. I haven't read anybody in the automotive press give their impressions of driving it yet, so I was just wondering if you all had. Take care. Bye.
You know, they just had this week out in San Francisco, the ride and drive.
It's going on right now as we speak.
And Jeff Green from our shop is out there, and I've been working on other stuff all week, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him. If we're going to take a few more questions, I'll send Jeff an email. This guy, his phone is like me, an electronic tether. He'll get back to us.
Sure. Yeah. In fact, we've got Chip Drake.
Chip's out there, right?
He's out there. He was doing a Cadillac thing the first part of the week, and now he's literally transferring over to the drive for the Jeep Grand Cherokee.
And for the record, I'm not allowed to drive Chrysler, so.
Oh.
Really?
Well, they don't send, yeah. Well, there's.
I'll say this.
I'm still banned from Aston Martin.
Yeah, because you wrote the truth. This Sunday on Autoline Detroit, we've got Michael Manley, who is the CEO of the Jeep brand and also the head of Chrysler's international operations. We get into a lot about Jeep Grand Cherokee. But again, none of us have driven it. I suspect they have all driving impressions embargoed for another week or so anyway, so you're probably not going to read anything official about it for another week or so is my guess. But,
So if Jeff responds to this email, he's breaking an embargo?
Well,
and he's just telling me I'm breaking the embargo.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. They can cut your head off. Ben,
Peter?
Let's bring... Oh, yeah. Sorry, Charlie, go ahead.
Peter, I'm just going to ask you, knowing your love of design, but do you think they went far enough with the new Grand Cherokee in terms of design?
No. A good buddy of mine has crawled all over the inside of one and says the interior is spectacular. But I think they didn't reach enough on the design at all.
The interior is great. I got to climb around it when they rolled it out at the plant.
But I think they didn't go far enough in the look of it.
I will say, I think the design looks really good. But I think part of the problem is, remember, it was Daimler Chrysler. Then it was Cerberus. And then it was the 363 bankruptcy. Now it's Fiat. And finally it's coming out. I think if they hadn't been through all that stuff, this thing would have been out at least a year ago. At least a year ago. And the design would look that much fresher to us. We've seen this thing for a while now. If not in drawings, then we've even seen it out on the street, and it's been around.
4 years.
Yeah.
But you know what?
John?
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me. I really appreciate Cerberus proving once and for all how easy the car business is.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth?
So you don't think Bob Nardelli should take over General Motors when after the IPO, when Ed Whitaker goes back into retirement?
It might bring the end faster. I don't know.
Bob just got a new gig.
Right, with some paper coatings company, which Cerberus owns.
Right.
So I remember.
Well, his job is he was the head of Cerberus Operations Group.
He saw what I wrote on the table.
Yes.
How long before he makes a pronouncement like, we're going to reinvent the paper industry, and then
we need to start papercoatingsextremist.com.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And how long before he's going to crap out of that company, too?
We've got a few more calls. Let's get through them. Ben, go ahead.
Hey, guys. This is Charlie from Madison, New Jersey. My question is, can any of you explain to me what GM is doing with Buick? I thought they were supposed to be a Lexus competitor, but with their new small car and such, they seem to be more targeting to be a premium Chevrolet. You know, in my opinion, they desperately need a flagship because while the LaCrosse is a nice car, it ain't a flagship. Thanks.
He brings up a really good point. It's one we have touched on, and that is, what is Buick's brand image? And they really couldn't give me a good answer when I drove the Regal last week. Again, they called it premium, and they talk about what the buyer is like, but there really isn't a brand image or a calling card. It does sort of need some kind of flagship car, or at least something that is a standard bearer for the brand to put the stick in the ground and say it's about style, it's about something. And I don't know what it is, to be honest with you. It's just another one of these premium brands that are nicer equipped and more expensive than Chevrolets, but not quite Cadillacs either.
Well, guess what? You know, GM jettisoned four brands, but I still think they need to go down to two.
Cadillac and Chevrolet?
There are real problems with that, though. One of them is, Jim Hall brought this up to me when the Treasury Department was talking about getting rid of Buick and GMC. The second pickup truck on a GMC Sierra customer's buy list is not a Silverado. It's an F-150. GMC vehicles get on average, I think, $4,000 in pricing more than the Chevy. So you could lose a lot of customers and a lot of revenue. And then, and this is the kind of daisy chain of things you get into. To make the GMC franchise viable, you need the Buick car side of it for some more volume. So if you keep one, you sort of have to keep the other, and they don't want to cede all of that volume. Look, from a marketing and brand standpoint, you're right, and it puts them in a real quandary. But from a real revenue and profit standpoint, Buick and GMC make some sense for them.
Okay, well, if they one car they could do and not bump into Cadillac is a new Riviera.
Yeah.
A drop-dead, gorgeous, beautiful Riviera, statement car.
They should do it on the rear drive platform of the G8.
Well, yeah, they could.
We've talked about what they could do with that platform for the Buick brand.
But if they do a reimagined Deuce and a Quarter, then you got a problem. Because if you do a really drop-dead Deuce and a Quarter, I'd love that. Bring that name back, too.
Uh-huh.
And then it bumps against what? Cadillac, a premium Cadillac. So they could do a Riviera, though.
Charlie, what would you do?
I think they have to appeal to an affluent but much younger audience. I say affluent, I don't mean truly affluent, not in the rich will always be rich, David. But and I think the new reskinned Opel they're bringing out, if they do that correctly and if they price it correctly and it does all the good things it could possibly do, could be a step in that direction.
But would you keep Buick and GMC or would you chop it down to just Chevy and Cadillac?
Our initial when back in 2004, when we were writing Branding Iron, we said we would, if it was us, we'd chop it to the two. But and I think Peter's right, to Cadillac and Chevrolet. However, with life the way it is now, and David's pointed out some of the facts of life, it's very difficult to do that. And I think that you had some non-automotive people crawling all over that place for about 6 months, and they got persuaded to keep GMC and Buick, and I think for probably some valid reasons. So we assume that those reasons are valid. Then you've got to make Buick work. And I think you've got to do that you've got to make it smart. And that's got to be in the small, mid-sized area where the car just outperforms and outvalues anything else out there.
Yeah, I wonder. And the only reason I say that is, listen to what we're talking about. The Regal is really an Opel, but they're trying to make a Buick out of it.
They admit that, by the way. That car was supposed to be a Saturn, the one for this market.
Yeah, right.
And they killed Saturn, and they said, well, it's still a good car, and they made it a Buick.
But it's bad engineering. It's not, its DNA is not Buick. Its DNA is an Opel with a Buick badge on it now.
Buick has no DNA.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at. And now, to your point, is they're keeping it because the brand is successful in China. Well, is that really the right way to go to market in the U.S., is to say, well, it works well in China? And, I don't know. As I sit back and listen to you guys, I'm starting to think, yeah, get rid of Buick.
Well, John, we're all sort of being backyard quarterbacks or whatever. But I could see where Buick could be successful if they created a rather new Buick DNA. I mean, they say they want to go over after Lexus, which is a pretty safe target to say, because after you get past Lexus, the relentless pursuit of perfection, which they've walked away from, Lexus is a collection of cats and dogs as well. I mean, it's some bespoke vehicles, but an awful lot of rebadged Toyotas, or whatever you want to call them. But I think they have to create a position in this marketplace that substantially moves away from whatever Buick was, and appeals to a group that's in between people who are younger and can't afford something and people who can afford anything they want, and make it cool. And they are eons away from that.
And as a practical matter, now that they're out of bankruptcy and have all this cash, getting rid of a brand and a bunch of dealers, this would be the worst time in the company's entire history to try to get rid of a brand. They're out of bankruptcy, so they can't do it easily.
They're not going to do it.
Yeah, it's a great debate, and I'd talk about this issue for another hour.
But
it's just not going to happen.
I'd rather have it survive if they did a drop-dead gorgeous Riviera.
Problem is, we all agree with that, and there are probably people in GM who agree with that. But you put that in there with this, Buick Saturn Opel Regal, which is actually in and of itself a nice car, but it's not really engineered and designed with the intent, like John says, of being in the Buick family. And then you put it with a LaCrosse, which is sort of a modern, large sedan, and then you've got this SUV. And there really is no cohesive theme to these vehicles. You put them all together, you don't know whether you're on foot or horseback. It's just no real direction.
Well, they could have rebadged it and replaced the Cruze with it, too, if they wanted to.
Somewhere up in Maine, which even sounds bad as I say it, but I love it up here. And there are an awful lot of 10-year-old Buicks around here. And I got to tell you something. As I look at these cars, there is no way I could tell you what Buick's DNA was at that point in time. It was rebadged cheapness. So I think if they're going to make Buick a success, they're going to have to move beyond what, Peter, you and I might think based on the 50s and 60s, into something a little bit more modern. But if I had to pull on one part of their history at this point in time, it would be more toward the Grand Sport era than it would be to the Deuce and a Quarter.
I don't think Buick is never going to capture the youth. It's just never going to capture the youth market. I don't care what they do. So I would take just some good cars in lieu of that. But I don't think they're going to. I don't think GM's got the money to chase the youth market with Buick. As much money as they have, they don't have enough. It wouldn't happen in our lifetime.
That's a big head snap.
Yeah.
It is. Well, look, we've gone longer than we normally go, and it's probably a good time to wrap up the discussion. And I apologize to our viewers. We got tons more questions that we just can't get to tonight. hopefully we can get to some of them next week as
I'm
well.
I'm free the rest of the evening.
Well, you know,
free tomorrow too.
We've talked about this. One day we're going to do a show that's we're going to talk for 5 minutes, and then the rest of the show is going to be answering questions.
Yeah,
we should do 24 hours at John's.
Right. Hey, John? No,
but, yeah, go ahead, Charlie.
I've now had a minute to think about Peter's head snap. But my question to you, Peter, would be, we know that Buick is not going to succeed the way they're going. And to me, if they don't do a head snap in some direction, they're just going to sit out there and be in a stall forever. So
yeah, I agree. But
I agree with you that trying to appeal to a younger, slightly more affluent audience is a head snap. But if it isn't that head snap, they're going to have to do some up head snap.
Well, okay, as long as we're backing up, let's not dismiss Deuce and a Quarter, because what was the name attached to Deuce and a Quarter? Electra.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to do an all-new Buick, appeal to younger buyers, do some fancy electric...
Give it the Volt drivetrain.
Yeah, do something like that, and then now you'd be talking.
You got my attention with that.
Yeah, no.
And you know what?
That's a great idea.
The Buick Electra, and you could have the Carmen edition. and you could, like, you know, paint it pink, metallic pink or something, like Paris Hilton's Bentley.
Okay,
forget it. That might be the time to end this
episode. David gave us the greatest segue to end the show.
Could be a real head snap.
Hey, Charlie, it's been great having you back here.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, this is good stuff, and we'll definitely have you back again in the future.
Good to see you, Charlie.
Thanks a lot.
Good to chat, Charlie.
And remember, everybody, you can follow us at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit or twitter.com/AutoLine. Visit Peter's site, AutoExtremist.com. You can follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. Follow David Welch at businessweek.com or Bloomberg.com. See, I said that before you got to it. And Charlie, your website is brandrules.com, correct?
Correct.
Good deal. Remember, you can get all our programs on Stitcher through your smartphone, your BlackBerry. Check out our website. Check out Open Line Monday nights, and you can get all the info from our website on that. And thanks, folks, for having tuned in. Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.